From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Last week, as we memorialized the passing of Washington Post publisher Katharine Graham, another historic figure departed journalism's arena, Robert Bartley, who spent the better part of 30 years transforming the Wall Street Journal's editorial page into what is regarded as the prime mover of conservative thought in America, has retired. Bartley has passed the torch to the Journal's Washington columnist Paul Gigot, who joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
This is a tricky question to throw at you right off the bat, but why not? The Journal's editorial page is at the same time probably the most read and probably the most reviled in the country. Let's face it, the editor of the National Review said rather than making grand pronouncements, the Journal's willing to knock the teeth out of its opponents. It's a ferocious page.
I wouldn't describe it as ferocious. I would say that we're not on the one hand page. I think our style can be pugnacious at times, but if our style is so ferocious, I think that we must be doing something right because Howell Raines of the New York Times, when he was editorial page editor, did seem to imitate some of the style of Bartley and what Bob Bartley liked to call muzzle velocity for editorials. But I think it's too much to say we're ferocious.
And you say the New York Times, or rather the New York Times under Howell Raines, made an alteration in its pages. By that you mean it...
And stylistically. I mean, he revved up the RPMs. He also adopted one other thing that I think was a Bartley innovation, which is the campaign. That is, if you get an issue which you really are promoting. In Howell Raines' case, it has been campaign finance reform. You keep going back, and you keep going back. We've done that with supply-side economics, tax cutting.
And specifically and probably overwhelmingly, Whitewater.
The Clinton ethics story, broadly defined, no question.
This may distress you a bit, Mr. Gigot, but even liberals hail you as the smart guy conservative, somebody willing to lay out a well-reasoned argument to defend conservative policies, and even think outside party rhetoric on occasion.
You're trying to damage my career?
I'm thinking it now. With every word, it's going down, down, down. Everyone writing about this seems to expect a kinder, gentler editorial page under your watch. Is that what you plan to give it?
Well, I'm a sweet guy. We'll see. I mean, it's going to be mostly the same staff, which I think is a tremendous staff. And philosophically, I'm very similar to Bob Bartley.
You may very well share most of Mr. Bartley's opinions and those of the editorial page, but not that many people listen to this show. So just tell me, haven't you ever read the page and gone, that really went too far?
Yeah, I have. On occasion, I have read the page. On occasion, I've read my column after I've written it, and I've said, you went too far. So I think that is an occupational hazard.
Now, you're a political guy. Your column that you've written from Washington is called Potomac Watch. But when I think of issues concerning family values, homosexuality, abortion, I don't immediately associate them with the opinion of Paul Gigot. How are you planning to handle these social issues?
Actually, I've written a fair number of pieces about abortion politics and abortion policy over the years. I don't disagree with the Journal's editorial page position on that, which has been that we're kind of in the middle. That is, we think that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided because it was judicial fiat. When it comes to the gay issue, we have written about it from time to time, but mostly, I think most recently, only when it comes to the Boy Scouts and their First Amendment rights, which we believe their First Amendment rights to hire the scoutmasters they want.
Now, you said that the paper's editorial page was opposed to Roe v. Wade because it was judicial fiat.
Right.
I didn't actually look it up, but then I can assume you were also opposed to the Supreme Court decision with regard to the Florida recount.
That's highly tendentious. I think those are completely separate issues.
Well, Paul Gigot, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Recently, a big change at the other most influential editorial page, that of the New York Times. Times op-ed columnist Gail Collins will take over from Howell Raines, who has been elevated to the paper's editorship. Collins' work is known for sharp political humor on what is seen as a generally liberal editorial page. She joins us now. Welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, congratulations.
Thanks.
This is really something. After a long and distinguished career as a reporter and a columnist, you've been promoted to anonymity.
Well, you know, I've done that. Actually, I wrote my last column about a week ago, and I realized, looking up on my bulletin board, that I had from 1979 a column that was entitled My Last Column, and I've written last columns, I think, three other times since then.
Before Hal Raines, who has just ascended to the editorship, the editorial page at the New York Times had a reputation for equivocating, for being compulsively even-handed, as opposed to, well, opinionated. Is it a tough act to follow?
Hal is an extraordinarily tough act to follow, but on the other hand, I gave up a column to come to the Times to write editorials because of Hal, because it was so clear to me that he made this so much, writing editorials seemed to be so much fun and so exciting.
Now, obviously, the New York Times isn't just another newspaper. When it itches, governments all over the world scratch. But a big part of the job involves, I can't think of a more felicitous way of phrasing this, elites writing for elites.
Well, I think one of the attractions of the page is that you do have a sense that, like, decision makers read it. I don't know that it influences the decision so much as it influences the conversation, but that's the important thing about the Times, that it does sort of have a big voice in the national conversation about important issues. And to that extent, you're writing for elites. But if the stuff that you write isn't written in a way that regular people, regular readers want to read it, I guarantee you the elites aren't. The elites aren't that diligent themselves. They're not going to necessarily even follow through. You've got to be able to write stuff that's everybody wants to read.
When politicians are given free rein to write on the editorial pages, famously or maybe infamously, the New York Times has been in that position itself when it allowed Bill Clinton to explain his pardons of Mark Rich. Did anything happen at the New York Times to reexamine the policy of giving editorial space over to politicians?
No, but I must say that I was, I think, in China when that happened, so I can't really comment on what people said or didn't say.
All right, fair enough. But I'm wondering if the things that have happened in the past, like the Bill Clinton episode, like the Wen Ho Lee episode, are going to inform the way you run the pages.
Well, everything that the Times has done informs the pages in the sense that we have this we have a very strongly held and fairly extensive list of core beliefs that we just have always believed in, and you know, the issues change every day, and the things that were written about last year or the year before are probably not going to have much direct bearing on the things that are written about next year.
Congratulations again, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Gail Collins is the newly anointed editorial page editor of the New York Times.
Today, when a celebrity gets bad press, he's likely to fire his publicist. That may seem harsh, but not compared to his Mayan forefathers writing the king's press releases in the first century A.D. When he screwed up, he lost a lot more than a client. Kevin Johnston is a Maya archaeologist at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
We marvel at the persuasive powers of publicists today, but back in the Maya period, the scribes, as they were known then, were responsible for preserving the power of kings. How did they do that?
What's interesting about the Maya society, like many ancient societies, and what made the writing of the scribes so powerful is that only a small portion of the society could read and write. And in these early societies, writing had tremendous power, so much so that texts were generally read aloud to assembled crowds in large public ceremonies, some of them violent, some of them not, some of them involving captives, some of them not. But these must have been very politically powerful and persuasive spectacles.
So were the scribes reporters or were they publicists?
The scribes were publicists. We don't have any illusions about this information that's being reported as being objective and reliable. That is, the scribes sang the praises of the kings, and that was their duty. They were there to cast the accomplishments of the kings in the most favorable light. In some cases, we have conflicting records of events in the Maya lowlands, which makes us suspect that the reporting is not always accurate.
A lot of times I'll talk to fellow journalists who say, oh, I think I'm just going to sell out and become a publicist. Did scribes make a really good living?
We know that many of them did. We know, for example, that scribes, almost all of them, and perhaps all of them, were the kin of kings. And we found their houses at sites like Aguateca in Guatemala, and there the scribes lived in grand palaces, almost as large as the palace of the kings, which tells us, first of all, that they were wealthy people to begin with, but also that they played a very prominent and prestigious role in Mayan society.
So what happened when the scribes' patron monarch was overthrown?
Well, this is a very interesting event that occurs. It turns out that in warfare, not only were kings, enemy kings, targeted for battle, and not only were their courts targeted for battle, but scribes in particular were targeted for capture. And when captured, they went through a series of events which are shown on Maya stela. First, they were displayed publicly. They were humiliated, stripped of their clothing, although they weren't shown entirely naked. They often were shown wearing loincloths, which is nonetheless something which is humiliating for somewhat of an elite background. And then, in a very peculiar and bizarre practice, their fingers were broken. The fingernails were pulled out, and the fingers themselves were snapped, tearing the ligaments at the joints, so that the hands were greatly disfigured. And then the scribes were killed. Often they underwent what we call genital sacrifice, where their genitals were slashed. And then, quite frequently, their hearts were cut out or their heads were cut off, which is a standard form of Maya execution or sacrifice. But what's interesting about these stela in the Maya case is that they emphasize not the execution, which is the end point of this sequence of events, but the act of finger breaking.
You found a quote in a 16th century Maya dictionary assembled by the Spanish that seems to drive this point home.
I looked up the word fingernails just to see what I would find, expecting to find quite a bit. And in fact, I found one entry, and the entry is extremely interesting. It says, it lists the word fingernails, and then it gives a typical example of its usage. And translating its usage, it says, I have no fingernails. I am no longer the person I used to be. I no longer have power or authority or money. I am no one. And what this seems to describe is what the mural shows. The loss of fingernails seems to correspond to the loss of the ability to write, which marks the loss of political power.
Kevin Johnston, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Kevin Johnston is a Maya archaeologist at Ohio State University.
Next up, MTV turns 20. We consider its many contributions to world culture. Also, an artist who paints Bob Barker but thinks Georg Hegel.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 20 years ago, the miracle of converging self-interest created a television phenomenon. It was called MTV, a cable network that got free programming, while record labels and artists got free promotion, and American teenagers got free of the linear sitcom sensibility that had informed their parents' TV-gorging idleness. But what has 20 years wrought? Michael Nesmith, the ex-Monkey country rock performer who imported the music video concept from Europe, is unimpressed with the monster he created.
MTV is in its fading days and will slowly drift off the map. It served its purpose. Its time has come and gone. It's not global. It doesn't embrace, you know, the world village. So I look at it as a fading star.
Whether or not the network will enjoy another two decades, MTV has undeniably had an impact. Ann Powers, pop music critic for the New York Times, joins me now. Welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Nesmith just got done telling us that he believes that MTV is over, that it is a falling star.
Well, Michael Nesmith was always an artiste of the form, and it is possible that on some level, the jiggle videos of hip-hop and the sort of fashion displays of teen pop have made it harder for artistic video to happen.
We're 20 years into the MTV age, mm-hmm. the original MTV generation, you know, some of them are having stents implanted in their coronary arteries. As we look back and take stock of the first two decades, what ultimately is MTV's contribution to the culture?
Well, one word, Madonna, for one thing. The great blockbuster artists of the 80s, Madonna and Michael Jackson, would not have had the same kinds of careers without video, without MTV. That's one specific thing. The shift from music as something you listen to in your room and made up your own story to music coming with a story, that's something that I think is not that positive. But on the other hand, it's allowed for a new form of visual creativity, a new way of looking at film. It's probably been better for film and television than it has for music, frankly.
To what degree do pop artists of 2001 depend on the video as opposed to their innate musical talents to sell their records?
Well, that's a huge bone of contention among artists. I think, you know, rock and roll was always the place where you could be a freak. You could look weird. It's not really been that true for women, but you would have a Janis Joplin, for example, who wasn't particularly photo or videogenic, but had such charisma and such a voice that she could be a star. Now, I think often people, and especially women, are picked out because of their looks. Many kids are getting their primary source of music from MTV. They're not getting it from the radio. They're getting it from coming home and turning on Total Request Live. So looks matter much more, and I think the pressure for artists, especially women artists, to conform to a certain look has just grown much more extreme.
Is there any chance that the next 10 years we'll see MTV going back to its more experimental, conceptual roots?
Well, you already see that happening on M2, the other station, that tends to show more innovative videos. For example, the number one nominated video this year at the Video Awards is this Fatboy Slim video starring Christopher Walken, which is just Christopher Walken dancing. It's very bizarre and compelling, and that's the one that people like the best, you know? So I think there's an interest and a hunger for that. And like most media outlets, MTV feels itself having gotten to a rut, I think. And that's why M2 turns toward videos. MTV itself is experimenting with lots of different kinds of programming and never quite knows what to do. I think desperation will lead them back toward innovation as it does every media outlet that survives. And I do think MTV will survive for better or worse.
Very good. Ann Powers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ann Powers is a pop music critic for the New York Times.
Above all, MTV sends out the message to kids, you matter, your tastes matter, your discretionary income matters. Naturally, the kids agree. They identify with MTV. They want to go behind the scenes. So MTV has obliged its viewers by taking as its central theme the other shows on MTV. On the Media's producer at large, Mike Pesca, entered this endless feedback loop and emerged with this report.
To be a member of Generation Y is to have your every curiosity catered to. It's to know that you can clog your hard drive with information about the walk-on character who flitted across Dawson's consciousness for two episodes.
I think now in a culture of 200 channels and infinite internet content, what we want to do is deconstruct and understand every little aspect about how something is made famous and proliferated.
Brian Graydon is MTV's president of programming. That job once meant deciding if the 99 Luftballoons video would go into high rotation. Now a lot of the programming on MTV is shows about other shows on MTV. Take, for instance, the Video Music Awards.
What the hell was Rage Against the Machine bassist Tim C doing atop our set at the 2000 Video Music Awards?
The VMAs are more than the biggest night on MTV. Because of repeats, there are many, many nights. Tack on another dozen or so nights of reruns of the documentary on the making of the Video Music Awards. Brian Graydon explains the making of the first making of the VMAs.
You know, it was sort of almost accidental. We were sitting around maybe 3 years ago, and we were reminiscing about the Video Music Awards that we had loved. And then we realized, well, these were moments that really happened in culture. To get people excited for this year's show, why don't we go back and remind them how cool the prior shows were? So it sort of just happened as a promotional whim. And then when we first aired it, the ratings went through the roof. It was probably quadruple the time period. And it was like, oh, my God, we could really mine this because the audience seems to have an insatiable appetite for behind-the-scenes information.
Now, MTV has shown you our best this and hottest that and counted down our 100 greatest other things. But now to celebrate MTV's...
These days, the M in MTV stands for Making Of. The making of the VMAs. The making of the movie awards. A new show called Making the Video. Brian Graydon says MTV's viewers identify. Those idiots on spring break, the cast of The Real World, the guy who won the contest to be a VJ... Graydon thinks every kid is secretly saying, hey, I can do that.
If you think about the people in the MTV generation now, they were raised on The Real World, on Monica Lewinsky, on OJ. They were raised on Survivor. So they're used to the fact that sort of relatively ordinary people can be plucked out of obscurity and suddenly made famous, and all the accoutrements of fame are open to them. So I think they're fascinated by that process because they're like, oh, my God, even if I'm not a talented singer or dancer or politician, that could be me. And so I think they want the process deconstructed to know how they get access to it.
The low-tech way of getting access is showing up in person. That's what dozens of MTV fans, some with guitars, do each weekday in an effort to be invited onto Total Request Live, MTV's popular after-school show based in Times Square. The kids left to shout from the sidewalks below served as the perfect focus group of heavy MTV viewers. John McSweeney told me that all the making-of documentaries do creep into his mind when he's watching the source material.
If I think, like, something in the Video Music Awards was cool or something was, like, you know, something, like, weird went on, yeah, then you look forward to seeing it. But otherwise, like, it's something fun to watch.
Interesting thing. Now, you were nodding your head when you watch the awards. You kind of know that there'll be the special on it eventually?
Yeah, anything I want to know, I'm sure MTV would put it on. And...
Right, they're not going to deprive you of information.
Yeah.
Exactly. At a certain point watching these specials, do you say, you know, enough already, I don't care that much about MTV?
I care a lot about MTV. Like him, whenever I'm home, I watch it. That's pretty much it.
So when you watch the shows about the shows on MTV, have you ever said to yourself, it's all just a big commercial for MTV?
Definitely not. There are a lot of great shows on it. I mean, it's one of the greatest channels out there, but it's not a big commercial.
Brian Graydon sees his audience as possessing a level of sophistication unfathomable to anyone who's ever had to get up to change the channel.
They can know, for example, a group like the Backstreet Boys was quote-unquote manufactured, right? Put together down in Florida. There are a lot of great producers, et cetera, behind. They can learn all that stuff in behind-the-scenes information. They can sort of know that there's a level of artifice to it because it's been deconstructed for them in a documentary. And at the same time, they're like, yeah, I know all that, but I'm still going to kind of enjoy the music and buy into the fantasy. I think they get it on both levels.
So many shows about so many shows has another effect. It trains the viewers to become perfect characters for other MTV shows. Take MTV's attempt at totally transparent programming, The Real World. Not only does MTV ask real people to live in front of a camera, they have to try out in front of a camera so that the losers can be humiliated by other real people on camera. It's the Real World casting special. Mike, whose dream it is to be on The Real World, has been paying close attention.
It showed me what not to do because, you know, people get on there and they're like stripping naked. They're running around naked. And the way I see it, they're looking for people that are real. You have to be real. You can't go do any of these like crazy stunts and stuff like that because that's not you. You're not being real.
A few years ago, MTV tried to put viewer submissions on the air in a program called You Wrote It, You Watch It. It flopped. But now, Graydon says the talent pool might be up to the challenge.
You know, by sheer coincidence, we're actually doing a pilot called My Life is a Movie, where we have asked our ordinary viewers, you know, age 19 or whatever, to send us stories. And you'll just be so amazed that the stories are completely literate to how they expect and know a script will, you know, break down. And so we are pursuing that idea today, even though it didn't work 5 or 10 years ago.
From audience to artists in 5 to 10 years. Even if only a tiny fraction of MTV's viewers ever become on-screen or off-screen talent, MTV will be able to stock its shelves with programming. The training videos are being delivered via cable lines into the homes of America 24 hours a day. For On the Media, I'm Mike Pesca.
Now, kids may scream to get on Total Request Live, but once, in a simpler time, their grandparents lined up to guess the price of a Maytag washer. In fact, people still do. The Price is Right is the quintessential game show and one of the longest lived, now in its 26th season with Bob Barker on CBS. The program has so seeped into the collective unconscious, it's inspired an art exhibit in Washington, D.C., but we'll get to that in a minute. Long before Bob Barker, The Price is Right had a brief run on ABC and NBC, as Peter Breslow knows too well. In 1967, as other teens were grooving to the Summer of Love, he sat in the studio audience of The Newlywed Game. He won an Alan Sherman record on another game show that summer.
But my game show way of knowledge actually began years earlier, as a little kid attending a taping of the original The Price is Right with host Bill Cullen. It was then that I had my first inkling into television's ability to fool us. I had watched the show when I was homesick from school, but this time I was sitting in the studio audience. Everything on the set was brighter and smaller than I imagined. But the epiphany came before the theme music started, when Bill first walked on stage. He had a serious limp, a legacy of polio. But then, just before the red light on top of the camera flashed on, he perched himself on the side of his game show host desk, and folks in television land had no idea he was disabled. Bill Cullen, Bob Eubanks, Art Fleming, Gene Rayburn, Gary Moore, all game show gods. But really, who's the most powerful lord in the pantheon of hosts? Bob Barker, that's who.
I thank you for that wonderful welcome. Let us see the first item up for bids today, please.
It's an enchanting adventure playhouse.
Price is Right was just set up to be an approachable game show. It's easily understandable, and people can relate to the concepts behind it, you know, without conceptualizing about the whole thing.
Bob Barker is the leitmotif of artist David Jung's show at the Newmark Gallery in Washington this month. All around are paintings with obscured images of Bob and contestants rejoicing over winning items such as a 1972 Vega. You remember that compact Chevy with the aluminum engine that tended to melt? The artworks all look like stylized television screens with painted horizontal lines of bad reception. But at the heart of the exhibit are real TVs, six teeny tiny 4-inch ones, all broadcasting the same black and white noirish image. Bob Barker, the tall, a little smarmy television version of a carnival Barker, transformed into a chisel-jawed, romantic leading man, all set to a homemade soundtrack. Each TV is actually screening 900 stills taken shot by shot that, when played, look like a single flickering image, again obscured by lines of static. It's a shadowy close-up of Bob Barker and an overjoyed winning contestant puckering up for a big smooch. But really, with all the romantic heat being generated, it could be a smoldering scene between Bogart and Bacall in Key Largo.
This is by far, I think, the most powerful image out of the whole group. The gaze within them is so anti-game show. It's probably the image, as an image, it's probably the epitome of what I've been looking for within these images. Focusing more on the romantic narratives within them and then their connection to romantic cinema and then 40s and 50s cinema.
And that soundtrack, all noises created in the artist's mouth, humming and whistling and fake static sounds that are electronically manipulated. David Jung says the mumbling is the man in the image and the whistling is the woman, and they're trying to have a conversation. As he points out, this is all very deep.
If you throw that into the formula of Hegel's dialectical theory of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, the conversation which should be the thesis and the antithesis working against each other. The idea of the synthesis is that it should bring the two together, and the static noise is actually not allowing the conversation to continue.
So Jung, who started out poking fun at America's obsessive consumerism, has ended up with some serious art, and just maybe the apotheosis of our most enduring game show host.
As a spin-off of this, I have an idea of portraying Bob Barker as a figure from Persian mythology, Perry at the gates of paradise trying to bring gifts to God in order to get into heaven.
Whether or not God will have to guess their actual retail price remains to be seen. For On the Media, this is Peter Breslow in Washington.
I just one more question for you. Can you tell me the manufacturer's suggested price for an Amana freezer?
The Amana freezer, $659.
Have you considered going on the Price is Right?
The last blockbuster film of summer opened this weekend. Planet of the Apes transports moviegoers to a world where apes have taken over every aspect of civilization. But director Tim Burton fails to clue us into what AM radio would sound like in an ape-run society. On the Media thinks it might just sound like this.
Banjo in Saddle River, you're on the bench.
Thank you. I love the show. You cannot survive in this league without an alpha male, please. We have to have an alpha male in the four spot. And can we get at least one pitcher, just one, with an opposable thumb? I mean, you don't got to be Dr. Zaius to figure this stuff out.
Coco in Sioux City, your question for Jerry Spence.
Deeply regret the hurt my poorly chosen words have caused the baboon and bonobo community.
Not bananas.
Banani! No, answer, but brace yourself. It's time for the Grease Mansion.
When a chimp loves a monkey, can't keep his paws on no one else.
Of evolution, the school board wants to teach. Just maybe, we did not evolve from the human.
NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore.
You make me feel like a natural monkey.
Coming up, is Big Brother watching us? Garfield doesn't care.
I care. Stay tuned to On the Media from National Public Radio. Back with On the Media, I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, federal regulators made Rupert Murdoch's Fox Television Group the most powerful in the country by allowing it to buy rival broadcaster Chris Kraft. The purchase gives Fox ownership of two stations each in New York and Los Angeles. Such duopolies, as they're called, were forbidden until the FCC issued new rules in 1999. It's the sort of news that would have dismayed Eric Barnow. He died this week at the age of 93 after taking jobs in nearly every facet of a century of broadcasting as ad man, radio producer, filmmaker, teacher, historian, and archivist, and that's just a few. In fact, he wrote the book. His three-volume history of broadcasting in the United States is the work that critic John Leonard says everyone who writes about television steals from. Patricia Zimmerman is an author and broadcast historian. She says Barnow had an indelible impact on virtually every field he entered.
One of my colleagues said, here is a man who didn't live just one life, but lived many lives. You know, we often call him the shuttler, that he shuttled between so many different media worlds. It was hard to ever place him in one.
Let's talk about some of those lives that he lived. First, as a practitioner, he wrote commercials, he did propaganda, and probably one of the most important films he made is Hiroshima Nagasaki, 1945.
This film is a compilation film produced in, I believe, 1970, from footage that had been squirreled away, confiscated, and hidden.
This footage was kept under seal by the U.S. government.
Yes, sealed by the U.S. government, and through a very complicated set of machinations, Barnow secured the footage.
Now, they say that this is the most widely taught documentary in documentary studies and also one of the most potent expressions of anti-war sentiment ever put on film.
Yes, it is. 31 years after it was produced, you can show it to students, and they're moved and crying and touched. You can trace films like Eyes on the Prize and millions of public television documentaries, feminist documentaries, civil rights documentaries, all these films that narrate the history of America can really, you could see as having their forefather, if you will, in this film.
Having written the history of broadcasting, he then went on to look ahead, and what he saw was a nation that was producing huge media mega companies, media conglomerates.
He once said to me, these companies are now larger than most nations. Yet at the same time, rather than just focusing on gloom and doom, he would constantly say to me, you know any good independent documentary media that's blowing the cover of these people? So what I would say, his whole life is a life marked by worry about what are the media doing in American society and internationally, and also hope that there's always people doing courageous work.
Just this week, you were at a conference that included archivists and people interested in independent film and documentary film. What is it like in all those communities to lose somebody like Eric Barnow?
The passing of Eric Barnow is for us as though Gandhi has died, a person always steering us towards an ethical and moral and democratic course.
Patricia Zimmerman is a professor at Ithaca College, author and media historian.
Last week, we interviewed the New York Times medical correspondent, Dr. Lawrence Altman. He was exasperated by a company called Abiomed, which had slapped a month-long news blackout on the recent implantation of its newly developed artificial heart. Altman wrote a scathing article quoting ethicists and physicians who all agreed the blackout wasn't serving the public. Abiomed has since allowed its doctors to speak to reporters. We invited Abiomed to respond to its critics. Brooke has the company's response.
The company writes, Larry Altman seems to believe that patients surrender their rights to privacy and personal dignity when they volunteer to participate in high-profile medical device trials. Loss of privacy is indeed a risk of trial participation, but it need not be passively accepted. No one, not the press, not the general public, has a right for or right to real-time, intimately personal clinical details about trial participants. On this point, the presence of federal research funding is a straw man. Researchers are accountable to the public through full and complete reports of results, supported by documentation of unimpeachable integrity, not through patient-specific news briefings. And the company goes on, Abiomed believes that individual clinical trial participants can be sheltered from unwanted intrusions without compromising the integrity of public reporting of the progress and results of ongoing research. We've designed and tried to implement policies that serve the public's legitimate interest without victimizing the patient. We announced our policies well before the heart trial began. They are independent of how individual patients fare. Our efforts have engendered many more positive comments than criticisms from ethicists and physicians, and we are committed to the path we have chosen. Privacy concerns are not unique to Abiomed. Time magazine just ran a cover story about internet intrusion. Super Bowl attendees last winter had their faces photographed and compared to fugitives' mugshots. And every time we get caught with our pants down, in the back of our minds, we have to wonder if we're on that newest network phenom, Spy TV. No wonder a Lou Harris poll last year revealed that 92% of Americans are suddenly worried about their privacy. Is it possible that for the first time in the life of the American citizen, we have ceased to be flesh and blood, but merely the accumulation of our personal data?
I can answer that question. The answer is no, not because we shouldn't be concerned about surveillance and the long arm of the database in the year 2001, but because we've always had to worry about it. I speak from experience here. The year was 1965. I was 10 when I tossed a snowball against the brick facade of Kenwood Elementary School and got caught. My insane act of violence against masonry got me dragged into the principal's office to be read the riot act.
Bobby, you better straighten up. This is going on your permanent record.
Permanent record? Next year's teacher, colleges, employers, the military, they'd all know. I was doomed to a life of rejection, revulsion, fear. I would never make Colonel or Phi Beta Kappa. My dream to be Undersecretary of Commerce would go out the window. The snowball incident would snowball into my own everlasting hell. So, for the next 8 years, I was disgustingly well-behaved. Blackmailed, basically, with my permanent record. And with all due respect for Time Magazine and the opinion poll industry, there is nothing new about that. For all the hand-wringing about a brave new world of intrusion, public records have always been public. Marketers have always collected data to understand and sell to us. Wiretaps and intimidation by dossier, J. Edgar Hoover and Joseph McCarthy. Furthermore, spy TV?
When it's least expected, you're elected, you're the star today. Smile, you're on Candid Camera.
Richard Smith, chief technology officer of a research group called the Privacy Foundation, makes a living by sounding alarms, but he understands what has never changed.
Human beings naturally like to snoop. It's part of our makeup.
Yet, 225 years into the life of the Republic, we're all worried about our privacy. Why? What all of a sudden is so different? Actually, I can answer that question too. Technology. It's not just that the intelligence community purportedly has a system called Echelon that scans every email and satellite transmission foraging for security threats. It's that I myself went on the internet the other day to a people search site and within 5 seconds located my address and phone number. With that, I went to a site called AccuData.com. For $30, giving that information, I was supplied my Social Security number. Then I went to a site called US Search, where for $69, I obtained the names, addresses, and phone numbers of everyone I'd been in a real estate transaction with in the past 10 years. If I'd had any bankruptcies, a criminal record, tax liens, civil judgments, or a merchant vessel registered with the Coast Guard, they'd have found that too. 10 years ago, they'd have had to root around a fusty courthouse file room for 2 days. Big brother, big schmother. Now any clown can sit naked in his den and for $100 terrorize me, steal my identity, or God knows what.
Government, corporations, nosy neighbors, criminals who are committing identity theft. What we have today are lots and lots of little brothers.
Beth Givens, founder and director of the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse, isn't Chicken Little, exactly. Just put her down for guardedly apocalyptic.
A tremendous amount of information is being collected on us, and in the end it's being used in the same kind of way that George Orwell described in his book.
The book, by the way, is 1984.
Police now have the ability to discover evidence of crimes inside a home without ever walking through the door.
The technology allows the FBI to sift through thousands of private emails, selecting out...
The rental car company Acme uses global positioning systems...
Good morning. My name is Bill Brown. In this area, there are approximately 139 different surveillance cameras of all different sorts. and we can be seen simultaneously by three different surveilling authorities.
Bill Brown, a currently out-of-work proofreader and self-described anarchist, leads a unique tour of New York's Times Square, pointing out for appalled visitors just how much they are being watched. Some of the camera emplacements are innocuous, like the ones ABC uses for sidewalk shots in Good Morning America. But in the aggregate, Brown believes, this is ground zero for citizen repression.
The first and most important is directly above us is a globe-shaped camera operated by the New York City Police Department. This is circular and hidden behind a translucent globe. And that spares us from the trauma of seeing a unit swerving around and staring right at us while we point back at it.
The truly chilling thing, he says, is that video images are increasingly digital and storable in perpetuity, there to cross-reference against any other data in any other file. And it's all happening so gently, so incrementally, Brown says, we scarcely notice, until one day we wake up as slaves. The analogy he likes is frog soup.
The way you make frog soup is you don't boil a frog all at once. You raise the temperature very gradually so the frog never realizes that it's being boiled. You could find yourself swimming in totalitarianism and think that you were having a nice bath.
He may have something there. I saw some Chicago high school girls plotted outside of the MTV studios on 44th and Broadway. They were making arrangements to be in the studio audience for the next day's broadcast of Total Request Live. I told them they were already on Times Square TV.
It's exciting. Wow, we love TV.
Is it probably the Big Brothers watching you?
No.
You know what I'm talking about when I say Big Brother?
The show Big Brother?
No, sweetheart, not the show Big Brother. But you have accidentally detected the paradox. We like to hide, but we also like to peek. And that's something else that's changed. Not technology alone, but the powerful convergence of technology and the suddenly ready-for-primetime surrender to our basest instincts. Jerry Springer, MTV's Real World, NBC's Spy TV. And need I mention, for viewing a young woman's every waking moment on the World Wide Web, Jenny Cam. In the past decade, the hitherto social taboo called voyeurism has come out of the closet. It's no longer a secret shame. It's a genre.
12 strangers have been locked in this house. There are no newspapers, no TV, no privacy. Previously on Big Brother.
Cameras everywhere. It's horrifying, all right, but let he who is without titillation, or just plain suspicion, cast the first stone. The other day, I myself got spammed with an offer to secretly monitor my computer to see what my wife and kids are up to. Every email, every chat room, every website the ad for spyware promised. I deleted it, of course, but not before giving it some thought. Likewise, the pop under internet ad that flips surreptitiously under my browser window every time I navigate the web. It's for a tiny wireless camera I can plant undetected anywhere. Which reminds me, there's a private detective in Pennsylvania I need to talk to. The name's Martin, Michael Martin, a real-life Seamus. Gumshoe, private dick, and a man of few words.
Hello? Say, can you get me my permanent record? We can do that. That'd be swell. Email me when you get it. You know how to email, don't you? Just lift up your finger and click.
Oh, right. In my haste to whip you into a panic, I neglected to present that other side of the story. The side that says when you want information, you can go online or call a private eye to get it. That the ready access democratizes information, taking it out of the exclusive hands of government and into the hands of the people. That while we wish to be free and secure from surveillance, we demand surveillance to make us feel free and secure. And that all of this data floating around, while potentially threatening, also fuels and lubricates the consumer society.
It means we have more immediacy in our lives.
Marty Abrams, director of the Information Policy Center for the Hunton and Williams Law Firm, was the chief privacy officer for the data aggregating giant Experian, a company that keeps profiles on 215 million Americans.
We can go into an appliance store on a Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock, We can walk out of that appliance store with a $400 television with instant credit, and we can do that because of the immediacy of the information flows and the fact that we understand the information better. It means that a large manufacturer of automobiles will better be able to predict the types of cars that we will want 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road. It's really about an economy that is richer and more vibrant and creates more wealth for all of us.
See? What's good for General Motors is good for America. Or not. Man, at least in fourth grade, I knew exactly what I had to fear. Now it's hard to know if the accumulation of my personal data liberates, as Marty Abrams believes, or enslaves. Are we really being watched or just seen? Should I accept some level of risk of living in the information age, like I risk driving in my car, or should I become some sort of e-survivalist, hunkered down in an unwired fortress, waiting for the final struggle? Well, you know what? I can answer those questions, too. The answer is, I don't know. If I did know, I'd write a book. I'd call it Frog Soup for the Soul. Sure, some of this stuff is extremely spooky and maybe even a very bad deal with the devil. But if you were a tradesman 140 years ago, so was the Industrial Revolution. Privacy hawks like Beth Givens and Richard Smith say that we must act now or dystopia is around the corner. Fair enough. Isn't that the way society has always dealt with change? With laws, vigilance, and, by the way, information? Simply to adjust. Meantime, though, I've been dying to know whether the snowball incident was indeed immortalized in my dossier. Well, now I know.
So you got the dirt, huh, Sherlock? Tell me about the snowball incident. How bad is it?
Your permanent record has been shredded.
Shredded?
It is the policy that files that old are shredded.
It's gone?
It's no more.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Melissa Sanford, and Katja Rogers, engineered by Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sean Landis, Kathleen Horan, and Giselle Foss.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.